Good morning, and may it please the court. Summary judgment is a drastic remedy, and exculpatory clauses in releases are disfavored in Missouri. Those are two precepts of Missouri law that govern this case. This court in 1996 in the Alack versus Vic Taney case decided what were the limitations on exculpatory clauses in releases that were allowable in Missouri. Particularly, this court in Alack said that negligence specifically, and only negligence, can be released in these exculpatory clauses. The court also said that acts of gross negligence or intentional acts cannot be released. The difficulty in this case is that phrase, gross negligence, because in other cases, this court and other courts in Missouri have said there is no such thing under Missouri law as gross negligence. So part of the reason we're here today is to sort out that difficulty. And we would urge this court to adopt the reasoning of the Court of Appeals, which went to great lengths in its opinion to sort out that difficulty. And that would be to put aside the confusing labels of gross negligence, recklessness, or even willful and wanton conduct, and look instead to the definition and the underlying principles behind what sort of conduct those labels actually are talking about.
How do we get there from your two-count petition?
I'm sorry, the thunder, I couldn't hear you.
How do you get to that question under your two-count petition?
Under our two-count petition, well, first of all, Your Honor, I should say that to some extent the petition becomes to some extent irrelevant because we can't rest on our pleadings in a summary judgment motion. Nobody can rest on your pleadings. It comes to the evidence that is flowing from the facts. Mm-hmm. And the facts in this case are that the plaintiff, Ms. DeCormier, signed up for a basic motorcycle class. She was a novice motorcycle rider. She signed up for this class, and part of the goal of this class is to give adequate training to novice riders so they can get their Missouri motorcycle endorsement on their license.
Your opponent argues that it's not in the record as to her level of skill, whether she was a novice rider or not. Is that from the petition, or is there evidence in the record at summary judgment?
There's no affidavit to say that she had never done it. There is evidence to say that this was the basic motorcycle class, that the materials produced by the defendants was that this was for novice riders, and it was for not riders who did not have their motorcycle endorsement. I think at a summary judgment stage that there are reasonable inferences in favor of the non-movement, which is us, that she was in fact a novice motorcycle rider.
Let me ask this question this way, because you want to get to the final answer. Assume that there had been no summary judgment granted. What verdict director would have been given in this case other than an ordinary negligence verdict director?
I think the verdict director would have been similar or identical to the one that was given in the Hatch case, which the Court of Appeals in the Eastern District did ultimately approve, and that was based on a recklessness definition. And I think
But you don't even plead recklessness.
We don't use the word recklessness, but as the Court of Appeals pointed out in our petition, we do make the factual allegations that the defendants in this case knew or should have known that there was an unreasonable risk of serious bodily injury by their conduct. And that goes to the definition of recklessness.
Is there a difference between gross negligence and recklessness, or do courts use those interchangeably or differently?
They're used interchangeably to great confusion.
What verdict director would have been given? How would the jury, is there a cause of action called recklessness? Or is recklessness a term that allows you to get a higher amount of damages?
No, there's a cause of action called recklessness, and that was the gist of the Hatch case. In the Hatch case, there was a pleading of regular negligence and gross negligence. The trial court threw out the negligence case but allowed the recklessness case to go forward. And in the Court of Appeals, it was the jury instruction that was at issue in that case. And that jury instruction tracked the language which the appeals court in this case adopted to say that that the recklessness standard, it's a higher standard than negligence, so it's not to get more damages, it's actually a higher bar for the plaintiff, that the jury is going to have to consider that the defendants knew or should have known that there was an unreasonable risk that there that serious bodily injury was highly likely to occur. And the courts have said that that is a difference in quality, not degree, from negligence, because it's not a pure intentional act. An intentional act is that an actor intends the act and intends the harm to flow from the act. The recklessness definition is different in quality because there is a requirement that we would prove that the defendants intended the act, but we don't have to prove that the defendants intended the result. And that's the difference. That intentional, the intent of the act is not required in ordinary negligence. And that's the difference in this case. And under the facts in this case, and the reasonable inferences given to the plaintiff, and these are undisputed facts, and they haven't been disputed, they weren't disputed in the trial court, and they weren't disputed in the Court of Appeals, was that this organization, or these group of defendants who form an organization, had very specific training materials for their instructors. And those training materials specifically said that these are novice riders and that they are not to be sent out when there are inclement weather conditions, especially slick conditions. The undisputed fact which we presented was that under a certified weather report on that day in April, that there were rain, snow, and ice and mist present in the area. And
all counsel says you needed to have, in order to defeat summary judgment, you needed specific evidence of the conditions on the track that they were driving on at that time.
Again, at the summary judgment stage, as the non-movement, the reasonable inferences are given in our favor. And they never came up with any evidence to say that there wasn't. We came up with evidence to say that these were the weather conditions. It's undisputed. It was a national certified a weather report that the court can take judicial notice of. It's a governmental business record. And those were the conditions. They never came up with any evidence to dispute that. In fact, we asked them in interrogatories, explain the weather conditions. And they said they'd supplement those interrogatories. At the summary judgment stage, at that point, we met our burden that the reasonable inferences that we can, given the reasonable inferences that there were those weather conditions, that supported our allegations in the petition, and they came up with nothing to dispute. Really, this case comes down to whether or not summary judgment is appropriate in this case. And the basic premises of summary judgment standards come into play. Did we meet our burden once they have established that, yes, there was in fact a release? And we believe that the facts do show that they knew or should have known that by sending Cindy DeCormier out into these weather conditions, that it was highly likely that she was at substantial risk for, or unreasonable risk for, a serious bodily injury.
In order for you to succeed and for us to reverse, do we have to recognize a cause of action distinct from negligence called recklessness?
I think that in order for us to succeed, there has to be a clear definition of what gross negligence meant in the Alack case. And I think that definition, as the appellate court found, is the definition that is also called recklessness. I think that there is a cause of action for recklessness. That was in the Hatch case. And that is true through most jurisdictions, and it's replete through the learned treatises, which were the basis for that proposition in the Hatch case.
It's just not true in Missouri, where we've said repeatedly we don't recognize categories of negligence.
And again, as the Court of Appeals pointed out, recklessness isn't a category of negligence. It differs in quality, not degree. The courts have said there aren't degrees of negligence, but as I said before, there is an intent to the action, but there's not an intent to the result.
Like if you can do an act and you can do it intentionally, but there's not a tort of intentional conduct, but you don't create a new tort based on the state of mind with which something's done, but it may take it out of normal negligence, is what you're saying?
Correct.
But is it something in additional you would prove then? You'd submit negligence and submit, I think the question is, and then a verdict director based on negligence, and then separately submit the state of mind? Or would we have to create an entire new cause of action or way to submit a cause of action?
I think we can't submit on a basic MII negligence claim, and I don't think there's an MII claim for recklessness. However, as happened in the Hatch case, it's very possible to craft an instruction based on the definition of recklessness that has been adopted not only in this state, but in most other states, and has been adopted throughout history.
Generally, though, that adoption of recklessness refers to a, it's usually found in a damage instruction, not a verdict director, correct?
I think that is correct. That wasn't the case in the Hatch case.
Right. So other than the Hatch case, are you which was a court of appeals case, are you familiar with any cases from this court or other Missouri appellate courts that recognize a cause of action for recklessness?
The Turnbow case talked about the Missouri versus Turnbow case, and I believe that was an insurance case, and so they talked extensively about the definition of recklessness, and that opinion was relied on extensively in the Court of Appeals opinion as well. Mm-hmm. But other than that, especially dealing with these exculpatory clauses, for the 18 years which ALAC has been around, I think this is the first case, amazingly, that has addressed it.
And you're not suing for recklessness per se. You're suing for the injuries. They're raising an affirmative defense of release, and recklessness is your reason why the affirmative defense is not a winner. It's not your basis for recovery. It's your it's your affirmative defense to the affirmative defense. I'm not sure what you call it.
It is our position that we have, at the summary judgment stage, proven enough facts, given the reasonable inferences to us, that we can meet that definition of recklessness, that they knew or should have known that this was going to be an unreasonable risk that would be highly likely to cause serious injury.
I mean, recklessness has been recognized and defined in the Restatement of Torts.
The Restatement of Torts, Williston and Contracts, and the Restatement of Torts definition is the one which the Court of Appeals relied on extensively. It's not a new thing. It has been around forever. It just has never really. The difficulty is that the term gross negligence was used in the ALAC case, and we think that the definition of recklessness is actually gross negligence.
So you could win with us not mentioning or not trying to acknowledge any existence of gross negligence, but by acknowledging a cause of action for recklessness?
Correct.
Which would be brand new for us to do?
To some extent, but there's precedent to do so.
But not from our court.
Alec talks about it, but it wasn't in distinguishing it from the case before it. But doesn't
it mentions it, and if you look at the case that Alec relied on to come to that language, it cites the Restatement of Torts, Williston on Contracts, all of those learned treatises to show that, and that definition is the definition of recklessness, even though they call it gross negligence.
Before you sit down, talk about the Warner case and its application to you.
And the Warner case.
The one that references gross negligence and equates it to
utility case.
Willful and wanton conduct.
I think that case is completely distinguishable because, as the court said in that case, that was a regulatory case. It was against AT&T or Southwestern Bell, and the court specifically said in a regulatory scheme, these utilities give up a lot of their privileges. So in that case, when you give up your privileges, then you also give up a lot of your liabilities. And I think that's very distinguishable. This is not a regulatory case. And that's a good example, Your Honor, of when gross negligence is used in other contexts. It's used in professional regulation cases, gross negligence of architects, that term is used. But again, those are inapplicable. This is a tort case. This is not a regulation case.
Thank you, counsel. Your time has expired. You'll have some time on rebuttal.
Your Honors, it is our contention that the trial court was correct in granting summary judgment in our favor. There's no dispute that Ms. DeCormier executed the release, which had exculpatory language. The language was clear, conspicuous. There's no issue before the court that was before ALAC. The only issue before this court is whether or not the plaintiffs, in their two-count petition, actually pled a cause of action for recklessness. And it's our contention they did not. You cannot merely place in count two of plaintiff's petition the term recklessness and rise to the level of what recklessness has been defined as under the restatement. Plaintiff wants this court, as they argue to the Court of Appeals, to make drastic assumptions in an attempt to thwart.
But you didn't move to dismiss or move for a more definite statement. This was summary judgment.
That is correct, Your Honor.
So can you address it in terms of the facts, whether they were adequate?
In terms of the facts, we looked at this case, and the term recklessness is only a term. The facts and allegations that they pled do not, in our opinion, rise to the level of what needed to be pled for recklessness. Recklessness under the restatement requires a higher quality than negligence. The allegations that the plaintiff has pled fit under negligence. The actions of getting injured during training on a motorcycle are those of negligence. The claims that they have raised that someone
they
should have
they claim that there were specific guidelines or policies that precluded that required them not to hold the training on a slick or icy course, and that despite that they violated those policies by proceeding with the training.
They have broadly painted the policies and procedures. The policies and procedures are very specific. Thunderstorms, the policies enumerate all sorts of weather conditions that would preclude or should give a question to whether or not the training in a controlled environment should go forward. The plaintiff's allegations in their petition was the course was getting, quote, slippery and slick. They did not plead at any time, even in their petition, nor on summary judgment, that the actual course where the event was being taken place was slick or slippery.
Why isn't that a reasonable inference when they're saying that this is what the weather was in this area and pleading that she fell and injured her leg, and it may well not be sufficient to go to the, you know, the jury might certainly find that was inadequate. I would hope at trial they would have additional evidence, but if we're dealing with summary judgment where you get all inferences in your favor, why isn't that an inference that can be made?
It's not an inference that can be made because at the trial court level, they did not raise that the conditions existed where the course did. They had a very broad, generalized climatology report, which is not part of the record, which is not before this court.
Why isn't it an inference from the fact that an area is having ice and snow that a particular spot is, that it raises an inference of that? You don't have to find that, but I'm not understanding why that's not a reasonable inference from that.
And the court could agree that that's a reasonable inference, but the fact that that existed does not unto itself make the determination that the course was unsafe and that the individuals acting on behalf of the defendant intentionally placed the plaintiff in a condition or circumstances that necessitated she would likely have an accident.
And is that required for recklessness?
For recklessness, it is. There is an intent level for recklessness.
Well, they quote the restatement as saying to be reckless, a person makes a conscious choice of his, or I guess from the case interpreting it, of his course of action, either with knowledge of the serious danger to others involved in it or with knowledge of the facts which would disclose the danger to any reasonable man. So it's not necessarily subjective. It can be objective. That's why you're reckless, because you didn't recognize the danger.
Correct, but it requires both aspects to be present, and the plaintiff has not been able at the summary judgment level to prove those aspects. It would have been very simple for the plaintiff at the summary judgment level to bring in an affidavit from their own client saying the course was wet and slick. They did not do that.
Why is the climatology report not part of the record?
I didn't file it, and the plaintiff chose not to put it in the record. I presume.
He discusses it in the brief. But it's not part of the record.
It's not part of the record.
Is it in the record below, but it's not part of the legal file, or it's not in the record?
I am not sure if it's part of the underlying file. I know it's not part of the legal file. It was not before the Court of Appeals. With regards to summary judgment, if this court would choose to expand ALEC beyond gross negligence, which was not defined in the opinion, or intentional acts, that's, of course, the court's prerogative. However, it is our contention that if the court would go to want to add recklessness as another basis for which exculpatory clauses in releases do not apply, the court needs to set out what elements need to be proved in recklessness. If the court would just allow, which occurred in this particular case, the term recklessness to be placed in account without sufficient facts to establish the elements of recklessness, you essentially have overturned ALEC.
But of course, at this stage, we're at summary judgment. Excuse me. So nothing has to be proved. But we'd have to define what needs to be pled.
Correct. And it's our contention they did not plead recklessness, in their underlying count one or count two. Count one, in my opinion, is very simple. They pled strict negligence. Mm-hmm. The release applies to count
now,
one.
Where is the burden of proof on a summary judgment with respect to the instructions were not in inclement weather? Would you have had the, is your opposing counsel saying you had the burden of bringing the climatologist to say it was nice weather?
I'm inferring that's what he's saying, but on summary judgment, it's my understanding under ITT that we have to prove that the release existed, there was an exculpatory release, and that causes of action were released by that document. It then shifts the burden to the non-moving party to establish why the release would not apply. And they needed to establish, beyond just the climatology report, that in fact there were conditions at that course that required a heightened
so
level.
So if you brought a climatologist in and said, it's going to rain today, it wouldn't be enough to say it's going to rain today. You'd have to show, someone would have to say, it is actually raining today.
Yes, Your Honor, to some extent. What you're saying is exactly what we thought they would do in the underlying action. That is, submit an affidavit of their client saying that at the course on the day in April when I was taking this training, that the course was wet, the course was slick.
Does your argument depend on our agreeing with you that you can't draw that inference from the general climatology report? Or if we disagree that there could be an inference that the track was in an icy condition based on that report, you still have an argument why you don't think, why you think summary judgment was appropriate?
Yes. Right. And the argument is that even if you infer that the course was icy and slippery, you still have to get to a higher level of what the defendants were thinking. And that higher level is that they knew that putting this person out there,
so
she would definitely have an accident.
So do you have to have an admission and a deposition by the defendant to ever prove recklessness or intent?
No. No. You could prove recklessness recklessness through intent by deposing the individuals and asking them how many occasions in your experience do individuals fall when the course is more slick compared to a dry course. You could get the, quote, intent that they knew it was more likely than not an accident would happen.
You think it has to be subjective, not objective, what a reasonable person would know?
I think it has to be a combination. It could be subjective, but I mean from a standpoint of evaluating the course, it's always going to be a subjective evaluation that the defendants are going to make. I mean, no one would be conducting a motorcycle training course in today's weather. I mean, that wouldn't make sense. What we have here is twofold. One was the petition pled to allow the affirmative defense of release. And number two, even if you infer that there was recklessness pled, at the summary judgment level, did they meet their burden of establishing that there were elements of recklessness? And it's our contention they did not.
And you agree that they didn't have to use the magic word recklessness, nor did they have to have it in their prayer. It's the facts that were pled is what we look at that
yes.
rises to that level.
The facts that were pled that would rise to that level, and then to oppose the summary judgment, additional evidence to support that the level of negligence, for want of a better word, was higher to reach the recklessness level. That's what we're contending did not occur at the summary judgment level, and that's why summary judgment was proper.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
To clarify the issue about what's in the record and what isn't, I think it may be correct that the physical report of the climatologist center didn't make it into the legal file. However, since this was a summary judgment, there were statements of uncontroverted facts which had to be admitted or denied on both sides. And on legal file 5758, our statement of uncontroverted facts said on April 13, 2008, there was rain, drizzle, snow, and mist at the location of the class. That referenced the climatological report, and they admitted that fact. So that's an undisputed fact.
But did you say that the track itself, was wet or ice covered, or did you need to even do that?
We didn't provide an affidavit from my client to say that. That was part of the allegations in the petition. And again, we think, and they didn't provide anything contrary to that fact. So we think in terms of our burden, that report and those facts that was present at the location was enough to say that, well, if that's the weather conditions on that day, that's going to make it to the track. For the summary judgment level, I think that that's enough. Again, we're going to have to do more when we get to a jury, absolutely. Maybe if we even get to a jury, we'd have to do more. But at this, procedurally, we file the petition, they file an answer, and they rush to file a motion for summary judgment. So there was very limited discovery. We asked the trial court for additional time to conduct the discovery that we even got to. There wasn't a single deposition taken in this case of anyone. So I think that sort of goes to the fact of why summary judgment is such a drastic remedy.
You were denied your motion for more discovery?
I'm sorry?
Did you say you were denied the motion for more discovery?
No, we were granted a motion for 30 days to conduct additional discovery, and that discovery consisted of additional interrogatories. Some of those interrogatories...
But could you have taken a deposition or not?
I think we could have taken a deposition. It would have required a lot of travel and a lot of expense, and I think that at that point... it was determined that, well, let's decide this legal issue. They also could have taken a deposition of our client to see if, you know, she was in fact credible about the allegations in the petition. That didn't occur either.
Back to the procedural posture. I understand that this was ruled on in the sense of a motion for summary judgment as opposed to a motion to dismiss. But what I don't understand maybe is that you suggest that you have pled a cause of action for recklessness just because you've attached record information to a response for summary judgment?
In the exact wording in our petition said that defendants knew or should have known that the icing conditions of the range created an unreasonable risk of bodily harm, and defendants knew or should have known that an inexperienced rider on an icy or slippery conditions create an unreasonable risk of bodily harm. We think that that was adequate to put them on notice that this was an issue in our case, and the Court of Appeals agreed and cited that language in their opinion that at the pleading stage we actually did plead enough. But again, we can't rest on our pleadings, and neither can they. I have 12 seconds if there's any other questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel.